the Columbia Workshop, under the direction of Irving Reese. Ladies and gentlemen, the Columbia Workshop presents as its 31st program in a series devoted to experimental radio, the first of a new group of demonstration programs designed to acquaint you with the unusual properties of the human ear. Your ears have characteristics as definite as your weight or height, the color of your eyes, or the quality of your voice. Because these characteristics must be reckoned with in telephony and in transmitting programs by radio to you, the ear has been a subject for exhaustive scientific research. Modern laboratory equipment, scientists have learned a great deal about the amazing properties of this organ. And some of the apparatus developed during these studies has also been of great value in the fields of education, music, pathology, and allied sciences. The Columbia Workshop hopes to bring you from time to time on its schedule programs which will demonstrate and acquaint you with the interesting story of these inventions and achievements. We have been fortunate in securing the cooperation of scientists at the Bell Telephone Laboratories, one of America's foremost research institutions, where these studies have been carried on as an aid to improving the telephone for this and future broadcasts. Dr. John C. Steinberg of the Bell Telephone Laboratory staff, who has done a great deal of investigation on the characteristics of the human ear, will conduct tonight's experiment. Dr. Steinberg.
Many of us have marveled at the apparatus which makes radio possible, but are inclined to take for granted an ancient instrument without which radio could not exist. The human ear has been thousands of years in development, and its construction and function is vastly more intricate than the most modern radio equipment. Tonight, I wish to describe and demonstrate what is probably the most interesting quality of the ear, its ability to judge the pitch of sounds. What color is to the eye, pitch is to the ear. Without the ability of the eye to sense color, the world would be a drab place of black and white. Without the ability of the ear to judge pitch, the world of sound, in its various phases, from the sweeping beauty of music to the recognition of the voices of friends, would be reduced to a monotony of primitive sound. Let us begin the demonstration by listening to the very simplest form of sound, a pure tone. You undoubtedly notice that this tone was not pleasant to the ear. Now listen to the same tone again, and then listen while we introduce a minute change in pitch. In the latter tone, the pitch was varied only 3%, and at a rate of 6 times per second. The ability of your ear to appreciate this small change altered a sound from a lifeless tone to one having an almost musical quality, like the sound of a human voice singing a high note. Under normal room conditions, the ear can detect a change 1,000 times as small as the one you heard. Such pitch variations, when they occur in music, enhance the artistic effects. This is particularly true in the human voice, as will now be demonstrated by Mr. Douglas Stanley, distinguished vocal teacher. Mr. Stanley.
Few people realize when listening to the ringing tones of a great singer that the pitch and intensity are fluctuating over a wide range. There are two separate and distinct types of voice movement, vibrato and tremolo. The real singer employs the vibrato, and the crooner, that is, any performer who sings very softly close up to the microphone, absolute tremolo. This tremolo is quite similar to the warble tone you have just heard. The vibrato is characterized by a fluctuation of intensity as well as of pitch. A steady tone is very unpleasant to listen to, since it sounds dead and lacks freedom, vibrancy, and those characteristics of tone which we hear as good quality. I have with me in the studio two pupils, a baritone, Mr. Lawrence Reed, and a soprano, Miss Gertrude Gibson, who I will ask to produce tones as nearly steady as possible. You will notice the extremely unpleasant quality.
Oh.
Again, when the vibrato is too slow, the quality is bad. Mr. Reed will sing a tone with far too slow a vibrato, which he will then speed up until a proper frequency is attained. Notice the improvement in the quality as the speed of the vibrato increases. A pianissimo tone has practically no vibrato, and as the intensity is increased, the vibrato widens, until at fortissimo a very wide movement is heard. I will ask both Mr. Reed and Miss Gibson to show the swell on the vibrato. It is very difficult for a properly trained singer to produce a tremolo, but I will ask the soprano to try to do so. Notice the relative rapidity of the flutter. The tremolo occurs when the throat is in constricted tension and the walls of this cavity flutter. The tremolo employed by the crooner is a relatively rapid flutter, since it occurs from 7 to 11 times a second, while the vibrato movement is never more than 6.5 times a second and maybe as low as 5. The ideal speed is 6. When the absolute tremolo is amplified for broadcasting, the effect is very pleasant. The vibrato, which only occurs when the muscles of the throat are in opening tension, is the result of an on and off impulse to all the muscles used in the act of phonation. The breathing muscles coordinate with this movement, while they do not coordinate with the tremolo. The vibrato allows the singer to produce full free tones without building up tension on the muscles involved. It is employed by the singer for rhythmic purposes and for accent. It is also the basis of clean, clear-cut, rapid singing. All runs should be sung on the vibrato. I will ask Miss Gibson to vibrato 5 times and then a run of 5 notes, 5 tones of the major scale on the vibrato. I'll now extend this process and ask her to vibrato in groups of 4 and then run a scale. When the voice moves from tone to tone on the vibrato, all slurring or jerking is eliminated, and the singer is able to accomplish a true legato. Again, when a note is tied over through an accent or a beat, the accent is indicated by one vigorous vibrato. Where a slur is indicated on the music, the singer vibratos up or down, producing a pearly musical effect pleasant to the ear, in place of a slur, which is a form of steady tone, despite the fact that the pitch changes, and is therefore unpleasant to the ear. Mr. Lawrence Reed will sing part of Du bist die eine Blume by Schumann, illustrating these points. Du bist die eine Blume, so hart und schön und rein. Ich sah dich an und bellos, schleich mir in Fels hinein. Mir ist, als ob ich die Hände auf die Leiden soll. Every sound tone should have movement. The proper movement is vibrato. However, a tremolo sounds pleasant when amplified for broadcasting or recording, despite the fact that it is always associated with a very soft tone. Of course, the singer who uses a real vibrato gives a far more dramatic and compelling performance. And now, Miss Gibson will sing part of Madame Butterfly's entrance from the opera Madame Butterfly, illustrating the use of the vibrato. Singing should be done on the vibrato, which starts when the singer starts singing and never stops until he is silent. The steady tone is always anathema, since our ears only perceive a fluctuating tone as one of good quality.
Thank you, Mr. Stanley. The pitch of a musical sound is the position it has on the musical scale. And this position is simply the one your ears would give it by comparing it with others of the same pitch and noticing the likeness. The ability of persons to recognize pitch varies to a high degree. Some people acquire by training and aptitude a remarkable ability to place tones in the musical scale when they have no comparison to aid them. This ability is referred to as absolute pitch. We have in the studio Mark Porno, Columbia's well-known conductor, who is noted for his keen ability to assign pitch values to musical tones. We are going to sound several tones and ask you and Mr. Porno to place their pitch value. See if you agree with his answers, and then we will tell you how close he came to being right.
Well, that was a main natural above middle C.
Correct, Mr. Warnow. The note you just heard was A above middle C. As most of you know, the smallest pitch interval on the standard musical scale is a semi or half tone. It is the difference between a black and the nearest white notes on the piano. We will now give Mr. Warnow a tone that is not on the musical scale, but falls between two of the standard musical notes. See how close you can come to.
That was about an E natural, approach to an E natural above middle C.
As the note was halfway between E and F, above middle C, Mr. Warnow's answer was correct. He was not only able to place the tone, but was able to tell approximately where it was located on the scale. We will now sound the tone very much nearer to the standard tone, but still not on the musical scale, and see how closely Mr. Warnow can place it.
That was almost a B natural around seven tones above middle C.
Right, Mr. Warnow. The note that was played was 1/8 of an octave above B natural. The difference Mr. Warnow was able to detect was so slight that it would be undetectable to many people. Now listen carefully and see if you can detect the difference. While we first play the note Mr. Warnow recognized and then the standard note nearest it. Thank you, Mr. Warnow. The demonstration you just heard of absolute pitch sensitivity illustrates the delicate qualities of perception the ear is capable of, where it has been trained to perform such work. But your own ears are called on each second they listen to sounds to perform even more delicate work unconsciously. Without pitch sensitivity, a violin and a piano would sound almost alike to you. In the next portion of our demonstration, I should like to show just why they do not sound alike and what your ear does to make the difference. All musical sounds have a fundamental tone and several additional tones called harmonics. Such a sound can be likened to a house, the foundation of which is the fundamental and the harmonics the structure, floor by floor. There is not very much difference in the kind of foundation buildings have, but once the structure rises, they vary considerably. Here is a fundamental tone, like the foundation of a house. Now we add one harmonic. The building starts to rise. Now we add two stories to the bass. Now the fundamental plus three harmonics. You noted that as the harmonic structure was built up, the tone began to assume more identifiable musical proportions. All the tones you just heard had the same fundamental or foundation. The addition of the harmonics changed the quality of the tone, but not the pitch. Here is an interesting demonstration. Listen to a simple tone played in fundamental tones only. Now listen to the same tune played in harmonics only, with the fundamental tone stripped. And now in fundamentals again at first, and then with three different harmonic changes. As you listen, remember that the same notes are being used each time. Only the harmonics are being altered. So you see that each tone has a foundation called the fundamental and several floors called harmonics. The architecture of the floors or the style determines whether it is the tone of a violin or piano or voice. A note of the same fundamental pitch heard on a piano and then violin differs greatly in its harmonic structure or architecture. The ability of our ears not only to recognize the fundamental of each note, but also to register the duration and loudness of each of its many harmonics, is chiefly what enables us to distinguish between instruments. In a symphony orchestra of 100 or more instruments, playing several notes per second, the varied harmonic structures, the ear is called on to do a more delicate work than any man-made machine could perform. Listen for a moment while we play a short selection on the piano, with and without the harmonics. And then the same on the violin. Now the same on the violin. Response to these quick harmonic changes is what keeps open the entire world of orchestral and voice tone color. It is often surprising to learn how far the quality of a musical sound can be distorted without the ear regarding the pitch as having changed. This is especially true of the human voice. Miss Rhoda Arnold, soprano, has been kind enough to assist us in the experiment. As she sings, the lower harmonics of her voice will be removed, marring the richness of her tonal quality, but the pitch will remain unchanged. Miss Arnold.
One magic night within his heart,
When you hear a sound, your ears act instantaneously in bringing to the brain a message for it to interpret. Fast as they act, however, a chain of many things must happen as the sound penetrates its way through the delicate and intricate labyrinth of the ear. The central and most important organ is the inner ear, which has the form of a snail shell, filled with liquid, and has along its surface an extensive row of nerve fibers. The nerve fibers may be likened to a long row of piano keys connected with the strings of the brain. The pitch range in human beings varies according to age and the individual characteristics of the ear. No two persons' ears respond the same way to high and low pitch sounds, but the degree of pitch separation that the ear can identify is nearly the same in all humans. And this knowledge is used in music and in radio to a great extent. You are undoubtedly familiar with a musical scale, of which the following is an octave. As we noted before, there are 12 semi or half tones in an octave. Here is an example of a semitone. What you heard then was the difference between A and A sharp on the piano scale. It is the smallest tonal difference that separates any notes on the piano. But how close must two tones correspond before the ears cease to tell them apart in pitch? Here are two tones only 1/8 of a tone apart, or 1/4 of the distance of separation from the closest tones of your piano. You should have been able to hear the difference between these two tones. But suppose we strike two tones 1/100th of a tone apart, like this. Could you tell the difference? The point where you cease to be able to distinguish tones determines how close the musicians must tune their instruments for your enjoyment of their music. The nerve fibers of your inner ear, which is the ear's keyboard, send high tones to one section of the brain and low tones to another. But when tones such as you just heard come too close together, there is an overlapping of the fibers affected, since in the structure of the snail shell inner ear, there is not complete separation in the action of the individual nerve fibers. Consequently, if pitches are too close together, the brain finally ceases being able to differentiate them. For pitches in the musical scale, the sensitivity of the average ear is such that tones may be detected which are about 0.3% apart in pitch, or 1/20th of a semitone. Closer distinctions can be made under certain acoustic conditions, which we will demonstrate in a moment, or when rapid changes from one tone to another permit comparisons. I will now have the violinist play two tones, a semitone, apart. He will now play two tones, 1/20th of a tone apart. The average ear can detect that difference. To illustrate the point more strikingly, the piano will accompany the violin, first in perfect tune, then with the two instruments out of tune by 1/4th of a tone, and then out of tune, 1/20th of a tone, in perfect tune. And now, 1/4 of a tone out of tune. And now, 1/20th of a tone out of tune. close tones must be to appear of the same pitch depends on the pitch of the tones themselves and somewhat on their loudness. Tones of medium location in the pitch scale are most easily told apart, and low pitch tones are told apart with more difficulty. You heard on the workshop programs in other demonstrations a great deal about the acoustics of studios. You have heard of live rooms, which reverberate sound, and of dead rooms, whose walls absorb sound so that no reflections come back. Most musical instruments sound better when the room or studio in which they are played has some degree of liveness. Just why this is so is a psychological question, the answer to which is not altogether known. But it is interesting that one's ability to detect changing pitch is as much as 100-fold greater in a live room than in a perfectly dead one. This is something you shower bath singers have known for a long time, without perhaps being aware of the true reason. Your voice sounds very pleasant to you in the bathroom, which usually has tile surfaces reflecting the sound. Then, as you step into the bedroom, which usually contains rugs and draperies absorbent to sound, disillusionment comes. Here is a little experiment which will enable you to judge which of two studios is more lively. We shall play a steady tone in Studio A and then in Studio B. See if you can tell which is the live one. The steady tone in Studio A. The steady tone in Studio B. You could not tell whether Studio A or B was the more lively. Now we shall play tones whose pitch is modulated or changed, and unless you are listening in a room of pronounced liveness, you should be able to tell clearly which of the two tones is the livelier. You undoubtedly were able to tell that the second of the two studios was the livelier. So you see how these studies of the human ear invariably lead to improvement of devices which are built to cater to them. For example, this studio which we are broadcasting from has a live end and a dead end, so that programs which depend on a great deal of color of tones, such as symphonic broadcasts, are picked up from the live end, other programs, such as dramatic plays, in the dead end. Not only do these studies of the characteristics of human ears contribute vital information in the construction of rooms acoustically, but in the design of telephones, microphones, and receivers themselves, great care is taken to see that the harmonic beauty of sound comes to you with much of the fidelity your ear would hear it in the room.
Thank you, Dr. Steinberg. Ladies and gentlemen, the Columbia Workshop has presented the first of a group of programs dealing with sound and the human ear. Tonight's experimental demonstration was on pitch and pitch perception. This broadcast was made possible by the assistance of scientists of the Bell Telephone Laboratories, one of America's foremost scientific research institutions, where such studies have been carried on as an aid to improving the telephone. Dr. John C. Steinberg conducted the demonstrations, many of which were based on investigations conducted under the direction of Dr. Harvey Fletcher of the laboratory staff. The workshop wishes to acknowledge its indebtedness to these men and to Mr. T. E. Shea and Mr. John Mills, whose generous help is enabling us to present this series on sound and the human ear, the next of which will be heard in about 4 weeks. We always appreciate your comments on these programs. They aid considerably in shaping future presentations. The Columbia Workshop presentations are arranged and directed by Irving Reese. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.